Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. Last September, I was invited to a conference of the International Council for Middle East Studies titled Faith, Community, and Culture, held at the University of British Columbia in Kelowna. My previous podcasts with Norton Mizvinsky and Rabbi Jacob Shapiro were recorded on that occasion. This podcast, with Professor Emilio Ferrin from the University of Seville, is the third of my conversations on that occasion. An eminent historian, he has examined Euro-Arab cultural cooperation, early Islam, and Islamic modernization. Central to Professor Ferrin's perspective is how he understands Islamic civilization to be distinguished from Islamic empire and the recent development of Islamism. Put another way, how has it come about that religionism and a curious kind of nationalism have come to be wedded in the mind and heart of some, forming a new identity, claiming to be that of pure Islam? In the Quran, it says that when there is no more trade and no more friendship, the world ends. Ferrin's deep study of the living tradition of Islam sees its central gift as brotherhood across societies, languages, cultures, and even religious commitments. Islamism, to the contrary, is a bricolage made up of disparate elements, creating an ideology of religious substitution adopted by those who see themselves and their societies as impotent in the face of colonial and modernizing forces. This is the root of its apocalyptic and puritanical view, creating silos of identity anchored in nostalgia for a past that never existed. One is faithful to the extent one becomes a warrior of the last day. My sense is that this should not surprise Christians and secularists, since we have similar reductionistic movements in our world. Welcome to our conversation.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
I came back. If you want, we may talk, but now it's midnight there, so yeah. If I didn't call him, so it was going to be really late.
How old is he?
13.
13, oh, wow. Well, the world is unfolding.
Yes, yes.
That's for sure. Mm. So you're at the University of Seville.
Yes. I wasn't born there. I didn't study there, but I simply chose that little and very old city.
I was there a year ago or so when some Turkish colleagues of mine who do an annual conference on issues of religion and violence and peace and what have you, they're all Muslim. I'm sort of their token Christian. So they held it in Seville. I was in Romania prior to that. So I flew from Romania to Seville. I'd never been in Spain before. I was delighted they were holding it there because I wanted to visit the place where the great Russian novelist Dostoevsky has the setting for the legend of the Grand Inquisitor, which is, San Francisco Square in Seville. And so I was able to do that and bring Dostoevsky along with me so we could have a talk yes. there in San Francisco Square. What a beautiful, beautiful city. I couldn't believe it, you know. When you come from where I come from, which is cold and snow, and to sit in a place where you could live your whole life outdoor.
And we do, indeed.
And oranges on the trees. I mean, it was just extraordinary to me. So today, in your talk, which was very provocative and lovely, you had four conclusions. And I would like to just ask you a little bit, if that's suitable, about each of these conclusions and have you just fill that out a little bit for me, and maybe I will wrestle with you. a little bit around them. So the first one, what was the first conclusion? You talked about religionism, or how did you frame that?
I can't remember exactly the way I coined it, the four conclusions. So if you remind me.
Well, what I've written down here is religionism and nationalism.
That's it. Yeah. This is the wider
is,
one.
Which really, you really see as kind of forced and founded by colonialism.
Yes. To me, as I see the question over the last 30 years, traveling all around the Islamic world, I find that there's a certain religious nationalism overwhelmingly settled in the Mediterranean. For any reason, for any particular reason, I can't understand completely. Now we've decided that it is our religion what is going to identify us as social beings. To me, that I am not I am not a nationalist at all. I am proud of the things that could have happened in my country, the country I live in. I find that a European passport is very useful, but I think that I could be a citizen of any other country. So I won't defend the happiness or the joyfulness of being Spaniard against any other nation state. So if in 10 years I move to Canada and I find myself having a Canadian passport, it will be okay. But I found that people doesn't like this. They project their own identity not as persons but as part of a group. And they project this not to the future as I do it myself. My identity is what I want to be. But as part of a group that has been something. So they project their own personal identity inside a group, and they feed the ideology of that group from the past, not from what we want to be or to do, but for with what we've been. And so if
or what we imagine we've been.
Exactly. It's a narrative. It's a narrative. We tell a story. And we tell the story of the Jewish communities in Spain or elsewhere. If I am today a Jewish, I find myself represented by a certain past and not by my own ideas. So that's why I think that religionism is a kind of religious nationalism that is substituting our ensemble of thoughts by a certain ideology inserted by a narrative of the past. That's why today the monopolizer of all the ways of salvation, as Max Weber called the representative of the religions, that's why this man now has a lot of power, because he's the new political leader.
So it's nostalgia.
Yes.
It's nostalgia.
But it's nostalgia in the very sense of nostalgia, in the etymological sense of nostalgia, is aching of something that we may not name. Mm-hmm. So we simply feel the vacuum. We feel mm-hmm. the loneliness surrounding us. So in a way, we need to be corporatives. I grew up in the idea that we are a group when we are young, and we are a couple when we are matured, and we are alone by ourselves when we grew old. And I was happy with the idea of meeting myself, of, I don't know, going to myself in peace with myself facing the future. But now I find out that I must be the only one who is thinking like this, because people tend to advance in groups. And as I see how the social networks are working, we are not in a globalized world anymore. The theoretical globalization of these social networks at the very end has created very small villages, because I can only breathe, I can only speak, I can only get in touch with those people that are exactly like me. So I think this is the disease of our times. The genuine zeitgeist, the spirit of our times, is that we are living in a connected world, but we are cutting these connections.
It's odd, isn't it, when you think of what the Islamic world means by the Ummah and by the whole community, which in the history of Islam has been understood to include enormous amount of difference, different nationalities, different tribal groups, different languages, different appearance. Or similarly, what the Christian community is understood by ecclesia, by the nature of the church, which was never about a fraternity, never about, not even about like-mindedness, about certain shared belief, of course. But even more than shared belief, it was a shared language of wonder, a shared language of thanksgiving. So you have said that this new, and you call it religionism, that this comes about in part at least because of the colonial period.
Yeah, I think so.
Did I understand you?
Yes. Islam is a threefold phenomenon. On one side, it is a civilization. I always say and write that it was never a whole and unique empire. Only the Ottoman Empire can be an Islamic empire, and it didn't represent the whole Muslim community of the world, and it didn't represent the whole history of Islam. And so Dar al-Islam, that means exactly the house of Islam, was no more than a lot of regions connected by something. This something could be sometimes the language, the Arabic language, but some other times were the Turkish or the Persians or the Urdu. Sometimes could be religion, but not necessarily, because we accept as historians that only with an Islamic power could coexist different communities, religious communities. So it was not that important to be a Muslim inside Dar al-Islam. And to me, the core of this Dar al-Islam, of these civilizations, is trade. It's a commercial way of understanding things. It's what they call discretional trade. I mean, I don't control the whole route of my goods, but only this part. So I own, so to say, a caravan from Cairo to Alexandria, and you from Alexandria to Tunisia, and your friend from Tunisia to Morocco, and we are connected, but we are not subjects of anything. So in this world based on trade, in this world based on your word and my word, because we cannot travel with all that money, the solidarity, the way of cutting the bread together was the utmost act of humanitarian connection during the whole Middle Ages. This is the genuine input of Dar al-Islam in relation with the Roman Empire. It's not an empire with their tentacles all over the Mediterranean. It's the power of communication. In the Quran is written that the end of the world will come when there will be no more trade and friendship. And all this tradition about cutting the right hand of the thief is simply because when we share the bread, when we share the food, we eat with our right hand. So those men without right hand are out of the community.
So it's really a description of something that's happened. It's really saying that there are some people that, even if they still appear to have a right hand, have actually spiritually, psychologically, practically cut it.
Exactly.
Because they're no longer sharing in the communication.
Exactly.
They're no longer eating bread together.
Exactly.
They're no longer in a situation of solidarity and trust.
Exactly. As you perfectly said before, ummah is the sense of community. Mm-hmm. But it's not the sense of a religious community. Mm-hmm. It's a brotherhood, because ummah comes from that is mother. Mm-hmm. So we are sons of the same mother. So we have to behave because we are that. This is the genuine ethical revolution of Islam, and nobody understands it in its historical terms. What did it mean that you could be from Cordoba or from Nishapur in a distance of more than 10,000 kilometers in between, and you could feel at home because you knew that you are sharing the values, not the tenets, not the dogmas, but the values. The values of the power of word, the power of communication, the power of trust.
It's a whole another kind of free trade deal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. So the second one, the second of your conclusions, I'm having difficulty reading my own writing, but it had to do with...
I may have it with me.
Sure. A secularist in Muslim countries. Oh, yes. The 20th century, I believe it was. You saw the 20th century as being basically secularist.
Exactly.
In the vast majority of Muslim countries. So first of all, by saying that, is that simply saying that in most Muslim countries, certainly the ones in the Arab world, and some others as well, that with the changes that came about at the end of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, that the various national leaders that were installed or gained power did so with the West's support, and they supported secularists?
Yes. I think that religion is an ideology of substitution. We've been in this meeting that we've celebrated here in Kelowna, we've seen how the Orthodox Christians, how the Catholics in South America or Africa, how the Muslims living against a regime, a dictatorship or a colonial regime, how even in India, not necessarily being Muslim communities, but also Hindu communities, they react against, how religion took the role of an ideology of substitution. When you cannot have any other power of resistance, religion is there. So in my opinion, after all this said about what could have been Islam during the Middle Ages, it turned into another thing absolutely different when they had to gather people against the occupant, against the colonial rule, against the dictator. So just as the gospel, in my opinion, was not written to serve the inquietude of those black communities in South Africa, it is not its direct objective or target. Of course, it can be used in this sense because it gives us a sense of freedom, a sense of solidarity, a sense of wishing and aiming for a better world. And so, just like this, Islam today, after the colonial push into the whole Muslim world, is acting as an ideology of substitution. And the oblivion of all the previous history of Islam is forcing all these new generations of Muslims of having only a single, a very thin and rough and tough idea about what Islam could be. It is no longer a brotherhood. It is no longer a system of free trade and communication and trust between communities. It's an ideology of substitution. It's a clash of not exactly civilizations as they intend us to do, to think, but a class struggle.
I invited the Mufti of Damascus. This is before Syria fell apart. I invited him over here. He hosted us in Damascus as well. And he was here in Canada on a couple of occasions. I had very interesting conversations with him. He's a well-traveled man. He spoke around the world very often in Muslim communities, but of course he has religious leadership for the area of Damascus very directly. And I remember the last time he was with us in Canada. This was, you know, less than a year before everything fell apart in Syria. I remember him making a kind of plea. He said, we need help. We need help. He said, young Muslims around the world, they watch CNN. They watch the news. They see what's going on around the world. So they only have two models of what it means to be Muslim. The one model is the jihadi model, the militant model. They see that on television. And the other one is a kind of secularist, to discard the religion, pay no attention to it, ignore it, doesn't mean anything. He said, so we only have those two models. And he said, it's heartbreaking to us that those are the two models. Now, he was speaking here, and I suspect most of the people listening to him would not have been able to say much about that the other models, perhaps, that may exist or maybe do not exist. But you are speaking of one of those models too, which is the way in which Islam was understood and the way that community was shaped prior to the colonial adventure.
This is a lost narrative. I find that as historian, I've learned to stop trusting the texts that much, because texts are saying us exactly what the authorities that in charge of these texts wanted us to read. So at the end of the day, every single history is no more than a story written by someone trying to sell something to the future. So the oblivion about what was Islam before the colonial powers, before turning or becoming an ideology of substitution, all this is deliberately forbidden, deliberately forgotten and not included in our schools or in their schools, in the case of Muslim schools, because now what we are living is bricolage Islam, Islam of two or three things that you may use it as
cobbled
tools.
Together.
That's it.
You've cobbled them together. They come from different places.
Exactly.
They were never made to be together, but you can put them together.
You can put it together and put it in your backpack.
Right.
And you behave as such simply because you have four ideas in your brain now. I think this is the worst way of understanding a universal culture as it was Islam in its beginning. I think that any Muslim today should be proud of what Islam means. If they could take a look at exactly what meant Islam in terms of culture, in terms of solidarity, of ethics, of getting in touch with the other. Islam was not a weapon at all. But now it become that simply because nobody is telling us the reverse of the story. Once I was in Tangiers and I saw a book written in Arabic, Hiwar al-Hawarat, Dialogue Between Cultures. And I said to my editor, could I translate this and we publish it? Because it's very interesting that in the times of clash of civilizations, I found in a book fair a work entitled Dialogue of Cultures. And he told me, I don't see that this could be appealing. I don't see that the public will love to buy this book. I mean, if the name, if the title would be, I don't know, Killing in the Name of Allah, perhaps it's going to be interesting to translate it, but not
or
exactly.
Or the Diabolical Between Cultures.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We've created a character of a contemporary Muslim, and this title does not serve our purposes of perpetuating this image of the Muslim. We've created a new otherness. During the 60s and 70s, we created the otherness of the red one, the man on the other side of the Iron Curtain, and then we simply substituted this otherness.
Right. Right. So on the one hand, you say that you don't, as a historian, you've learned not to trust the narratives from the past, to understand that they are narratives, they are stories, they're usually told by those who have held power as their way of sending a message about who they are to the future. But they're different than the bricolage Islam that you're talking about now.
The problem, if you can read too much, and this reading can be dangerous, if you read the same several times, if you read different things, it could be very useful. The problem is to read only one thing several times.
Right.
And if you only take a look at one version of our history, this is a dangerous thing about it. This is really interesting what happened, in this sense, it's very interesting what happened with the history of the Crusades. Because we had a version of the Crusades till the 70s, 80s, and then the book written by Amin Ma'alouf, The Crusades, as the Arabic Chronicles tell us.
Right.
And it was exactly the opposite.
Right.
And now we have
the mirror
versions.
Image.
Exactly. We're now two versions. I used to work with my friend, I used it in the past to work with my friend Robert Down almost 8 years ago in Vancouver, about what I called historiology. Historiology as how to search the genuine mechanism of history. And he defined one day historiology as the history obscured, so that you cannot hide anything. And we found a lot of examples that in between a certain inductive narrative of history could give us another impression of what could have happened. For instance, I found a poem, an innocence poem written by a man from Granada in Al-Andalus, the Arab Spain, to his beloved, and he said, "I am following you by the streets of Granada like the Christians are following their saints." So this is an innocence verse in a love poem that gives us exactly the impression of what could have happened in Granada. It means that the Christians were practicing their pilgrimages in Granada. So it was a genuine time of coexistence. And now we forget this interaction of different persons in the single place, because we are trying to write the history with three or four colors, and not anymore.
Your third conclusion, the whole issue of the obsession with purity.
And finality, and... Yeah. Yes, I use... Of course, you have to put yourself on the shoes of your students or your audience, but when I am in Spain, I used to tell the story of a very good friend of myself who is a diplomat, who was ambassador of Spain in Egypt, and he told me, "It's funny because I still have my first passport." And in this passport, issued in the 50s, in the Franco era Spain, under the strong dictatorship of the Franco regime, in the last page of that passport was written, "Spaniard, do have in mind that with this passport, you are the best man in the world. Behave as such."
Wow.
So this idea of be proud of yourself because the rest of the world is simply left men while you are, half men while you are the great man. This is exactly what's happening today. During the Franco era, they told to the Spaniards that we were the religious reserve of the world, the last religious tenet, the last religious fortress of the world, because we were Catholics. So we had this responsibility of behave as true Spaniards, true Catholics. Well, this sense of determinism, this sense of immanent, ultimate idea of who we are is exactly what is happening today in the small and dark communities of Islam inside Canada, inside the United States, inside Europe. They are telling the young Muslims, you are better than the rest of the people you meet in the street. Don't mix with them. You are not part of this world. You have a bigger call, a bigger appeal. Behave as the ultimate hero of those times. Islam today is becoming an apocalyptic message, and it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous because it's going not dangerous for the West or for the countries. We have a lot of possibilities to tackle, to solve problems, because we've had wars in the past, we've had strong terrorist groups in the past, and this is part of our way of keeping in order our house. Now, it's not dangerous for us, it's dangerous for Islam, because how can I grow as a young Muslim in a world that is telling me that being a Muslim is not being a good person, but the ultimate warrior of the last days? So what is happening today is the worst thing that may be happening to Islam. In fact, when a religion turns into a terrorist group, is the end of this religion as we know it.
Right, yeah.
It happened in Spain during the 9th century. The last Roman Christians in the south committed suicide against the troops because it was too easy to be Christian in this world, in this complex world, and they wanted to be surrounded exclusively by ourselves.
I have sometimes thought that this impulse to the pure was a kind of mental illness. Hmm. That it is so foreign to how human beings live in the world that to adopt it and to struggle for it, that it becomes a kind of mental illness, and you keep isolating yourself. I can give you hilarious examples from the Orthodox world. There is, for example, in Colorado, a monk who is also a bishop who grew up in a fairly broad Greek Orthodox church, who himself as a young man became a monk and started to evaluate his church and realized that his church had problems in it. It wasn't really as good as he thought. It wasn't as pure as it should be. He found spiritual fathers to talk with who helped cultivate that notion. It isn't as good and as pure as it should be. You must be better than that. He ended up leaving that jurisdiction, going to a much smaller jurisdiction, which said they had the right calendar and the others don't have the right calendar. And the slippery slope begins. He ends up being ordained a bishop in one of these small sort of alternative Greek Orthodox contexts. He founds a monastery in America. Initially, he has some people come and live with him, but they're never pure enough. They're never pure enough. So eventually, they all leave. So now he is alone.
Absolutely.
And he is pure. Hmm. A very strange thing in a religion that says the very nature of human life is communion. A very strange thing.
Yes.
So purity is an odd phenomenon. Do you know Mary Douglas's book,
yes,
Purity and Danger?
Yes.
And what she does in that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yeah.
It's a kind of sociopathy.
Yeah.
You hate, it's like we may have agoraphobia surrounded by noise and people. We may have a certain sociopathy when we cannot look eye to the other person. Mm-hmm. I like very much the philosopher Levinas.
Oh, yeah.
Levinas,
so
when,
do I.
When he talked about ethics, not as part of philosophy, it's not a discipline, but prior
yes,
to
prior
philosophy.
To it, yeah.
So first of all, we have to take a look at the other, to find out what means to be in front of the other. In these times in which we love in the movies the apocalyptic version of a planet invaded by zombies or by people from other planets or plagues or disease, in my opinion, the genuine end of the world is to be alone, is to be an outcast, to be out of society, to speak a language that you cannot share with the other one, to have the capacity of being good and not having anyone who can be pleased with this. So the genuine, how is it called when it's the contrary to a utopia?
A dystopia.
Dystopia. The genuine dystopia of this world is a man standing alone in the whole world. And this is exactly what your purity you were describing drives us.
It's curious, in English, it's not used as much anymore, but for a long time throughout my childhood, we would typically say for somebody who was sick that they were an invalid.
Ah.
And of course the word means they are invalid. They're not valid. So it brings with it all of the notions of confinement and restriction and quarantine. I spent a little time in Lithuania where Levinas grew up. And I have a great affection for him. I'm very struck by how he says that ethics does not begin until you meet another human being who you do not know and who perhaps you will never understand.
Exactly.
Then it begins. That's ethics. Meeting people you know, meeting people who are like-minded, who agree with you, finding safe places. I mean, we have a lot of this language now in this part of the world, even in university classes, you know, where the university class, you get memos from the administration. It has to be a safe place. And I wonder to myself, what do you think education is? You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I understand what they mean about not expressing things that deliberately harm people. But it seems to me we've gone further than that. And so we've, in a sense, created a kind of sectarianism, in which everything is seen in terms of a silo. Do you know the word silo?
Yes.
Yeah. Everything is seen in terms of a silo. And Levinas, his wonderful way of speaking to what I guess I would say is that as a human being, you do not even begin to mature until you meet the other and have wonder awakened in you about the other.
It's funny that he uses the image of Robinson Crusoe, the novel Robinson Crusoe, mm-hmm. And the chapter in which he's meeting someone else in the island and will be called after the words Friday. But yes. He said, what's that?
Yeah.
And he finds another human being in front, another kind of person. He cannot share a common language, a common way of dressing up. And this is exactly being in this world.
Yeah. I'm also was very moved when I read Levinas's reflection on the tractate, the Talmudic account of in which it says that if the high priest is on his way to the temple on the highest holy day of the year and comes upon a body, someone who has died in the street, and there's no one to bury that person, it is incumbent upon the high priest on the Day of Atonement, the day, the only day of the year, the highest day of the Jewish year, the day that the high priest enters the Holy of Holies, the only day that the name of God is spoken, the day that they tie the rope around the high priest's leg in case he has a heart attack in there and they can pull him out. You know, on that day, if he encounters someone who has died with nobody to bury him, it is incumbent upon him to pollute himself and bury the person. On that day, there will be no Day of Atonement. Ethics, burying the person who is dead, is greater than the Day of Atonement itself. It's an amazing description.
Absolutely, yeah.
Of the sort of ultimate value of awakening to the other. And my own sense is it's the only way we really learn about ourselves and awaken to ourselves. Hmm. Well, not the only way.
Do you know that this is exactly the sense of also the New Testament in some passages, and it is also the image of a certain Prophet Muhammad when he was in his way to Medina, I think, and he found a rich man beating his slave.
Yes.
And he told him, stop beating him. And the other one said, no, I'm doing what I want. This is part of my position, so I can beat him. And I'm going to beat him even harder after you told me to stop. And then the Prophet Muhammad simply stood and waited. So the rich man said, what are you doing there? Why don't you leave? And he said, I am waiting here because I want to buy your slave. And he said, no, I'm not going to sell it. And he kept on beating. And at the very end, he said, what are you doing here? What are you still standing here? And he said, because when you kill him, I'm going to buy you the body because I want to bury this man. This man has his rights, and I'm going to please him with this. So that image of an ethical prophet is, of course, in the very core of Islam. And this is the most forgotten part of the whole history of Islam.
And then the fourth conclusion.
Ended with a dramatic appeal, saying that Europe, the Western world, has a lot of place for Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and Jewish, but it has no place for Islam, Judaism, or Christianity as such. And it goes back to the idea of the confessionalism. We cannot create societies with stank compartments inside. We cannot create silos, as you said before. You cannot suffer the idea of what I mentioned in Arabic as tahakkum, meaning the double legislation. How must I behave in this society? Well, you can behave ethically, as your religion says, and politically, socially, in terms of laws, as your government says. But you cannot have two lords. You cannot have two masters, so to say, as in the gospel is said. So we've creating now, as far as I know, at least in Europe, we are creating treaties between the government and communities just in case they need another legislation. This is foolish. You cannot give the impression of a believer that he is under a double legislation. This goes against the very sense of brotherhood, the very sense of melting pot that was in the very core of our societies, the very sense of being a citizen of an open society. I don't need to know if the man or woman sitting beside me is gay or hetero, Muslim or Jew, I don't know, vegan, or he or she loves flesh to eat. But today we are walking in the street with a lot of labels. We need to be part of something.
As you were speaking about that earlier, I was thinking about the situation here in Canada. We had a case in Ontario here several years ago where a Muslim organization and lobby group lobbied the government for the recognition of Sharia, of their community Sharia court. Now, in Canada, we have a long-standing recognition of at least two courts which have some standing in Canadian law. Not absolute standing, but the Canadian law will recognize their judgments if their judgments aren't contested. The one is a Jewish court called a Dim Torah, when rabbis gather together and make a judgment. Normally, it's a judgment around divorce and inheritance things. The other one is the Roman Catholic Tribunal, which similarly primarily makes judgments about whether a marriage was sacramental or not. But we introduced in Canada a few years ago another court. It is called the Sentencing Circle within the Aboriginal Native communities. You know, our prisons have a high percentage of people from First Peoples who are in them. So a lot of poverty and difficulties in those communities. So finally, after a long debate and struggle, the state decided it would grant to Native communities a certain amount of judicial authority around the sentencing of people from those communities by the state. And these sentencing circles were the ones that were given the opportunity to decide what really should be done about that particular person. Muslims who were beginning to feel some interest in the civil institutions and power read about these sentencing circles in our papers, and they said to themselves, oh, well, that's the same as a Sharia court. We can have a Sharia court. So they then wrote letters to the newspaper, they lobbied politicians, and one politician said he was in favor of this, he was part of the government at the time. An election was lost over this because other people were horrified. We were going to have Sharia courts. But the part of it that is striking to me is that if I'm right in saying that the Dim Torah, that the Roman Catholic Tribunal, that the Native Sentencing Circles, these are forms of a Sharia court. And they have a very modest standing. In general, they only make judgments about ostensibly family law, some aspects of family law. And it is also the case that if somebody does not like those judgments, they obviously can come to the civil court. And the civil court will simply do its own work associated with that. I know that in the Vancouver area not long ago, within the Ismaili community, there was two businessmen who had a great deal of money invested in a project. They had a falling out and a problem. And instead of going to the civil court, they came to a Sharia court. The Ismailis put together a very competent group of people, and it took them 2 years. But within 2 years, they were able to negotiate a situation where everything was worked out, and it never had to go to the legal court. So here's what I want to ask you. The normal way of thinking, or at least I think, of thinking about this matter is that Sharia courts in this part of the world The fact that they didn't get any standing didn't mean that they disappeared. They still exist. They do what they do. But the government has no eyes on it, doesn't know what's going on there, because they exist within the community, within the community's boundaries. And to the degree that a group of people hold to those principles and to the authority of the Sharia court within, say, a Somali community or an Iranian community, to the degree that people are still committed to that, they will go with their dispute to the local community Sharia court. Nobody will know anything about it. There will be nothing written in the newspaper about it or what have you. And a decision will be made. If the decision is problematic for one of them, and if they have enough self-confidence, they could then go to the civil court. The arguments, the standard argument is that in the case of disputes between men and women, the women are at a big disadvantage because within the community, they're trying to juggle the realities of the community. So the women will end up being abused or hard done by in these circumstances. So it's one thing, or is it? It's one thing to say, we must be careful not to create a double system, and that does affect, obviously, our understanding of what it means to be a citizen. I think there are so many things that affect our understanding of being a citizen in this part of the world that this is hardly the first one, in my view. But in any case, is there also, in your view, a problem if, with the Sharia court existing as it does now, without any standing within the civil court, just as the Dim Torah, the tribunal in the Catholic Church, and the sentencing circle exists? Or do you see that as problematic? Or do you see that within community, the confines of a community, there is going to be things that can occur there, and as long as they don't bleed into the larger civil canopy, why bother with them? What do you make of it?
When I need to think about these kind of things, I used to take the idea and follow it till it's probably absurd. And if I follow this idea, I will find out that what will come next is to have a special court for gays, or to have a special court for those who doesn't like flesh, or for those who, guess why. So when I was in the 80s studying this program about humanity in motion, our professor told us that he found two very different and very illustrative cases of countries with a lot of communities inside: the Canadian model and the Lebanese one.
Right.
The Canadian model is you can be whatever you want, because facing the state, you are no more than a person and no less than a person. And the government, the state, the authorities are speaking to you as a person, as a citizen. But in Lebanon, if you were born as a Christian, you vote the Christian candidates to the Christian chair of the parliament. And if you are Shi'i, part of Islam, you cannot change. You are inside your stank compartment. So we may move towards this ideal Canada or this ideal Lebanon.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great to talk to you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. Professor Farhan has diagnosed a social pathology at work in our common world. It spans Muslim and Christian societies, as well as many political constituencies, with loud voices in the public square. This is reason enough to pull forward the deepest and most textured understanding and thinking about the gifts and dangers of religionism and nationalism that clothe themselves in its garments. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.